22nd of April 1915 dawned warm and sunny, and it was a beautiful spring day. The temperature soared into the 70s, and there were signs of spring everywhere, just like there is in England today. Green shoots edged up through the war-torn landscape and made every man recall home and spring days of his youth. But at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, everything was to change as the Germans launched a massive gas attack against the French, the British, and also the Canadians along the Gravenstaffel Ridge, east of Ypres. And this is what one German wrote in a letter home. He said, "In a few minutes we were over. We lay down and opened fire. Mines, hand bombs, and hand grenades flew every which way. We jumped up and in a few steps we were in the enemy trenches, smashing any attempt at defence that we encountered. In the captured positions, the sight was pretty grotesque. Our heavy shells had torn huge craters in the earth. Shelters and bunkers were destroyed, and in amongst the debris there were torn bodies and limbs of soldiers. There were not only white men lying dead, but we found black, brown, yellow and red. There was a complete mixture of races. Death had made a terrible harvest of them here. They all lay there, silent, stiff, most gruesomely ripped apart. We were amazed because we had thought there were only English soldiers opposite us. Now we saw we'd been fighting against people of many races. We'd been victorious, and the longed-for moment had come when the enemy trenches were in our possession." Another German, a man called Willy Sobert, he said this. He said, "Finally, we decided to release the gas. The weatherman was right. It was a beautiful day and the sun was shining. There was grass. It was blazing green. We should have been going on a picnic, not doing what we were going to do. About supper time, the gas started towards the French. Everything was stone quiet. We all wondered what was going to happen. As this great cloud of green-grey gas was forming in front of us, we suddenly heard the French yelling. There was a hail of bullets going over our heads that was unbelievable, coming back from the French, but it was not stopping the gas. The wind kept moving towards the French lines. We heard the cows bawling and the horses screaming. The French kept on shooting. They couldn't possibly see what they were shooting at. In about 15 minutes, the gunfire started to quit. After half an hour, only occasional shots. Then everything was quiet again. In a while, it had cleared and we walked past the empty gas bottles. What we saw was total death. Nothing was alive. All of the animals had come out of their holes to die. Dead rabbits, moles, rats and mice were everywhere. The smell of the gas was still in the air. It hung on the few bushes which were left. When we got to the French lines, the trenches were empty, but in half a mile, the bodies of French soldiers were everywhere. It was unbelievable. There were some English. You could see where men had clawed at their faces and their throats, trying to get a breath. Some had shot themselves. The horses stood in the stables, cows, chickens, everything, all were dead. Even the insects were dead." So welcome to another episode of the podcast that me, Terry Wenham, calls Tales from the Battlefields. And by the time this podcast goes out, it will be round about the anniversary, which will be, what, 108 years since the Second Battle of Ypres, which is infamous for the horrendous German attack using chlorine gas. Gas had been used in experiments earlier in the war, but this was the first time that it was used in any major attack. At a conference a few years before at The Hague, it was agreed between the representatives of several nations, including Germany, that such a brutal weapon would not be used between enemies that were still considered to be civilised. But by the spring of 1915, the Western Front had established itself. Both sides had dug in and there was deadlock, effectively. And the Germans decided to use gas as a way of breaking that deadlock. And it very nearly worked. Let's look at the words of the British commander at that time, the commander-in-chief, Sir John French. He said, "It was at the commencement of the Second Battle of Ypres on the evening of the 22nd of April that the enemy first made use of asphyxiating gas. Following a heavy bombardment, the enemy attacked the French division at about 5 p.m, using asphyxiating gas for the first time. Aircraft reported that about 5 p.m, thick yellow smoke had been issuing from the German trenches between Langemarck and Bichtrucht. The French reported that two simultaneous attacks had been made east of the Ypres Staden railway, in which asphyxiating gas had been employed, and what follows almost defies description. The effects of these poisonous gases were so virulent as to render the whole of the line held by the French division practically incapable of any action at all. It was at first impossible for anyone to realise what had actually happened. The smoke and fumes hid everything from sight, and hundreds of men were thrown into a comatose or dying condition, and within an hour the whole position had to be abandoned, together with about 50 guns. The left flank of the Canadian division was thus left dangerously exposed to serious attack in flank, and there appeared to be a prospect of their being overwhelmed and of a successful attempt by the Germans to cut off the British troops occupying the salient. In spite of the danger to which they exposed, the Canadians held their ground with a magnificent display of tenacity and courage, and it is not too much to say that the bearing and conduct of these splendid troops averted a disaster which might have been attended with the most serious consequences. So a lot has been written and spoken about this particular battle. There's a fantastic memorial that sits on the place where the Canadians held the line at what's called Vancouver Corner, and I'll mention that at the end of the podcast. But what I wanted to do today was tell the story, but as usual, not through the eyes of history, but through the eyes of the men that were there. The men, not just from Britain, but from Canada, those Canadians that lost their lives and held the line so bravely that French talked about. And we're also going to look at the situation from the German side as well. What did they see as they came across those fields towards the panic-stricken French colonial troops that were holding the line? And what did they see as they moved through the reserve lines as they headed towards the city of Ypres? That's what I like to do in this podcast. This isn't a technical podcast. This isn't about the strategy or the tactics. There are many other podcasts that will explain all that to you. In this podcast, it's Tales from the Battlefields. We want to know, what did the soldiers experience? But this week with a slight difference as well, because at this stage in the war, Ypres was still fairly intact, or it was until the Germans started pounding it with 17-inch shells in the few days before the gas was used. And within that beautiful city, there were still civilians living there, and also civilians living in those villages behind the British lines. Many had left the area and gone to live with family elsewhere, but there were still thousands of people living there. I'm not sure how many in total, but there were quite a few. And we can see what happened to those civilians when the battle began. By the end of the battle, the civilians had all left. They'd all gone, and they weren't to return until 1918, as the whole area turned into a desolate battle zone that was occupied just by the soldiers that were in conflict with each other and those that had died in the mud and the slime and the rubble of the Ypres area and had not yet been recovered, their bodies not recovered, and maybe they never were, and they're still there lying in those fields that saw such horror between 1914 and 1918. Now, what I should say before we go any further is that I've used a few sources for this podcast this week, and we're going to be following in the footsteps of a battalion, the Buffs, the East Kent Regiment, the 2nd Battalion, which was a regular unit, a professional bunch of soldiers, but they'd been depleted in numbers earlier on in the war, and some of the volunteers were already being fed as replacements into the 2nd Buffs. And one of those replacements was my own great uncle, Henry Stephen Wenham. His full story is told in the first podcast that I did, A Tale of Two Brothers, so you can listen to that if you wish to. But it's their story that I wanted to tell in amongst all the others in this podcast. So I've used their battalion diary and also a book written by R.S. Moody after the war called The History of the Buffs. And people know who listen to this podcast that one of my favourite authors is a lady called Lynn MacDonald, who died in the last couple of years. And she wrote a number of books about the soldiers' experience in the First World War. And the one I've used as a source for this podcast, she called 1915 The Death of Innocence. And the other source is another well-known book written by a man called John Dixon. And he wrote a book about the entire battle, the Second Battle of Ypres, and he called it Magnificent But Not War. And you can get certainly those two books by John and Lynn MacDonald are still freely available The book about the Buffs, the history of the Buffs. I'm not sure whether that is. I've had that for some years, but that may be out of print now. And later on in the podcast, as we look at the story of the Buffs, I've been using the newspaper archives, and in particular the Kent Messenger, dating from the spring of 1915. So what was the city of Eepe like prior to April 1915? It's a small city, and there were many fine buildings, and within the Cloth Hall there were rare tapestries and paintings, and pilgrims came to Eepe too. It was a noted religious centre for devout Catholics, and of course they flocked to St Martin's Cathedral. It was, as it is now, a beautiful place to live. And the 9th Royal Scots arrived there just before the battle, and there was an anonymous private who recorded his impressions of the city and what it was like to be billeted there. He says, "How comfortable we were. These days we lay in the high-walled garden in the sun. The afternoon teas we gave when some of us struck it lucky with parcels, and there were no bullets and no shells, only the far-off lights and the crackle and grumble in the distance. Our unanimous decision was that fatigues at Eepe were a picnic. We slept or lazed in the forenoon, and in the afternoon we strolled in the town, walks by the canal, omelette and chipped teas, shopping, patisserie tasting, lace buying, exploring the Cloth Hall ruins. All these we found time for in glorious weather, and very homely and pleasant it all was. We thought a lot of the gay little town where we had our happiest days since leaving home. For it was gay and full of people, the market square lined with booths on one side in front of the larger shops, although in the back streets there were shell-torn roofs and battered houses. And the Cloth Hall towered over it all, a gaunt and empty ruin, but every chipped and battered stone was eloquent, and its pinnacles still proudly cut into the sky." This really was the lull before the storm, wasn't it? And I wonder whether that man from the Royal Scots survived the battle, and whether he survived to the end of the war, and was able to come back and see the complete destruction of the city 3 years after he made those impressions. So let's go back a step, shall we? Let's go back to the night of the 13th of April 1915. And it was a night that gave the Allies a chance to change history. They were taken completely by surprise on the 22nd of April when the Germans unleashed the gas attack. But they did have a chance to be more prepared for it, because on that night, the 13th, a German soldier, Private August Jaeger, who was attached to the 234th Reserve Infantry Regiment, he decided to desert. The French trenches were opposite his unit, and he made his way several hundred yards across No Man's Land, which was littered with corpses. He crossed No Man's Land without any incident at all, and just before midnight, he turned himself in to the French, and in no time found himself marching away from the Western Front that he must have hated so much. Before he got too far, he was interrogated at the headquarters of the 11th Division of the French Army. And that interrogation could, and maybe should, have changed history. Because he talked freely. He gave detailed information about the German strengths and routines. But it was the last part of his statement which really startled his interrogator. Because this is what he said. "An attack is planned for the near future against the French trenches. With this object in view, four batteries have been placed in position in the first line trenches. These batteries each have 20 bottles of asphyxiating gas. At a given signal, three red rockets fired by the artillery, the bottles are uncorked and the gas on escaping is carried by a favourable wind towards the French trenches. The gas is intended to asphyxiate the men who occupy the trenches and to allow the Germans to occupy them without losses. In order to prevent the men being intoxicated by the gas, each man is provided with a packet of toast steeped in oxygen." What he meant there was the German attacking troops. There was also a second deserter, a man called Julius Russell. He was a former NCO, but he'd been reduced to the ranks for striking another officer. And this probably was the reason why he deserted. And he was also carrying a package of cotton waste to be used as a mouth protector. Although, but he claimed it was to protect him against a French gas attack. But when the attack didn't come at the time that the deserters said it was going to come, the French and the Canadians who were in the front line at the time, perhaps they relaxed, perhaps they thought it was a hoax and it wasn't going to happen. But of course, we now know exactly what did happen. There was more evidence on the night before the battle when a Canadian Colonel Curry of the 15th Battalion, of course he was later to go on to be General Curry, he said, "Whilst I was doing the rounds of the forward trenches, I could not help noting the roar of wagons and limbers along the whole German line in front of us. The night was very calm, and whilst it was usual to hear a lot of wagons about rationing time, still on this occasion the whole German line seemed to be in motion. I've never heard anything like it before. Something extraordinary was certainly happening. I reported the occurrence to headquarters that night." There was a Captain Ray, and he was serving with the 16th Canadian Scottish, and he noticed that in the enemy parapets had been changed around during the night. He could now see openings appearing at regular intervals, and he thought something must be afoot across no man's land. Of course, what he was seeing was the gaps where the gas was going to be released from the cylinders in just a few hours' time. Now, if we go back to that first deserter, August Jaeger, he survived the war, obviously in captivity, but the Germans found out what he'd done. They found out that he'd deserted to the enemy. And on the 17th of December 1932, he was tried in Leipzig on charges of desertion and betraying German plans to the enemy, and he was sentenced to 10 years imprisonment. And that was just before Hitler and the Nazis came to power. And just imagine if he'd have come to court during the time of the Nazis, I'm sure his sentence would have been far more serious than just 10 years imprisonment. There was a musketeer on the German side called Peter Amlinger, and he wrote a letter home showing how confident the Germans were. He said, "Within the next week, we can expect to launch a large offensive between Bischut and Langemark. Follow the news bulletins closely. The great offensive about which you wrote is a fact, and with some luck, there may be peace at the end of May. We also have a Dickie Bertha at our back, whose loud voice, although not so beautiful, will be there to support us." What he meant by Dickie Bertha was actually known to the British as a Big Bertha. These were the massive shells that could fire, as we talked about last week, up to 10 miles, 17-inch shells, which packed with high explosives, which would cause enormous damage to the Allies. Now, in the German lines that night, you could almost feel the suspense and the dread. The German trenches were packed with troops, and they'd been there for over 12 hours. At midnight, orders had been received to release the gas at 5 o'clock in the morning. Of course, that would give them the whole day to fight the battle and make their way through the Allied lines of defence. The German men were told to carry unloaded rifles with bayonets affixed. They'd been given respirators, and they'd checked to make sure they were damp. And steps and ladders had been put in place to climb over the parapets. As the Canadians had noticed, the German engineers had gone out to cut passages through their wire. And finally, the sandbags had been removed and their tubes laid over the parapets. But that wind that they'd been waiting for, which needed to blow northeast, had not come. And after several postponements, word was received at 5:30 a.m. cancelling the operation. And so those German soldiers, they were in those frontline trenches all day waiting for the wind to change direction. And what did they have with them? Nearly 6,000 cylinders lurking below the parapets. And when the orders came, those nearly 6,000 cylinders would spew out 149,000 kilograms of chlorine gas. Chlorine gas would get into the lungs of the defenders, fill their lungs with liquid, and eventually they would drown in their own blood. It would only take 6 to 8 minutes to empty the cylinders. The suspense grew. The men must become more nervous. And of course, on the other side of No Man's Land, the Allies, the French colonial troops, and the Canadians and the British further behind had absolutely no idea what was about to happen. But just after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, someone in the German trenches noticed that the breeze was beginning to pick up. Some of the Germans had been waiting with their helmets off, and they felt the cool sensation on their scalps as a very slight breeze heading towards the northeast wafted over their trenches. At 4:40 p.m. the word came, the valves on the deadly cylinders were to be opened at 5 o'clock. Colonel Arthur Curry, who we talked about earlier, was just a few yards northeast of St Julian, and he'd been inspecting the battalion's trenches, the 15th Battalion. And this is what he said. He said, "A heavy cannonade and rifle fire broke out along the northeastern face of the salient, along a sector held by the French troops. The rifle fire seemed to grow heavier every minute, and a strange yellow haze grew over the distant line of French trenches. What came next is absolutely horrific. That yellow-green cloud that we talked about had also been spotted, of course, by the frontline troops that were French colonial troops. They had sentries, and they saw what they thought was some puffs of smoke appearing at regular intervals along the German trenches. By the time these puffs of smoke, as what they thought, had formed into patches of dirty fog, hundreds of curious Frenchmen were peering out into no man's land. But that green cloud continued to grow, and it rolled silently towards them. The French were engulfed by this cloud. The medical officer at the 1st African Battalion wrote, "I had the impression I was looking through green glasses. At the same time, I felt the action of the gas upon my respiratory system. It burned in my throat, caused pains in my chest, and made breathing all but impossible. I spat blood and suffered from dizziness. We all thought we were lost. It grieves us to see poor Cordier. He was purple, incapable of walking." As you can imagine, there were shrieks of terrible fear, an uncontrolled coughing that filled the air. These soldiers must have been absolutely terrified as they clutched at their throats. And of course, the shock and the surprise, they were staring out in terror and pain, and many of them collapsed in their trenches, which of course is worse because the gas is heavier than the air. And when it found the trenches, the gas went into the bottom of the trenches where these poor men had collapsed. Some of the others clambered out and staggered to the rear in attempts to escape the deadly cloud. But of course, that's making it worse because the gas is following them. It's blowing in the breeze. They'd have been better actually going across no man's land. But then they would have met the Germans coming in the other direction. Those left in the trenches, they writhed in agony that was absolutely unspeakable. Their faces had turned plum coloured. And of course, as the MO said, they were coughing blood from their tortured lungs. Then, 10 minutes later, the German field artillery opened up. Shrapnel descended on the French. 10 minutes after that, at 5:20, the German infantry appeared, climbing over their own parapets and then into no man's land. And of course, they were wearing those cotton gauzes that the two deserters had spoken about. Then they reached the French frontline trenches. They were being hounded, the Germans were, by their officers to keep closer to the dreaded gas, almost using it like the creeping barrage that was invented in the following year. And all along the French sector, they advanced with little opposition. Well, of course, because the French colonial troops had fled, hadn't they? So what about those Frenchmen? Were there any survivors? Well, there must have been some, because we've got an account here from a survivor. All was so calm that we no longer thought about the war, so to speak, when suddenly around 5:30 that afternoon, we saw a thick cloud rising above the German trenches opposite ours. Surprise and curiosity riveted us to the ground. None of us at that moment suspected what was going on. As the cloud of smoke grew thicker, we thought that the German trench had caught fire. The cloud moved slowly towards us, but because of the wind, we saw it was being carried towards our right flank. Only the edge of the wave of gas reached us. It was less thick here, but gave off a singular odour and seized me and affected my throat with such severity that for a moment I thought I was going to suffocate. Suddenly, I heard cries around me. "An attack! The Boche are there!" I looked in direction of the cries. There were soldiers who occupied the area around the Sten Street Bridge running towards our trenches. Several fell on the way. To our corporal, who asked what happened, I heard them answer, "We've been poisoned." We received the order to leave the listening post and return to the frontline trench. Then all of my comrades, silent but amazingly calm, waited quietly, their eyes fixed on the German line, rifles ready to fire. There was a Canadian soldier called Ian St. Clair, and he was with the 13th Royal Highlanders of Canada. He said, "At first we thought it was just intense musketry that was creating this yellow haze, and it began to come onto us, and the French on the left started pouring into our trench, coughing and bleeding and dying all over the place." Another Canadian, Lance Corporal J.D. Keddy, was with the 48th Royal Highlanders of Canada, and this is what he said about that moment. He said, "My company was in the reserve trenches, and it was on the afternoon of my birthday that we noticed volumes of dense yellow smoke rising up and coming across towards our trenches. We did not get the full effect of it, but what we did was enough for me. It makes the eyes smart and run. I became violently sick, but this passed off fairly soon. By this time, the din was something awful. We were under a crossfire of rifles and shells and had to lie flat in the trenches. The next thing I noticed was a horde of French colonial soldiers making for our trenches behind the firing line. Some were armed, some unarmed. The poor devils were absolutely paralysed with fear. They were holding a trench next to the section of the 48th, so the 48th had to move in to hold it until some of their officers came and made those French colonials go back. You can imagine why those French colonial soldiers, called Turcos, fled when that gas cloud reached them. They didn't know what it was. They hadn't been trained for it. This was natural terror and fear of the unknown. That made them run. Surely that's a natural human reaction, isn't it? I'm sure, well, I always say in this situation, what would I have done? I wouldn't have been there in the first place, but if I had been, I'd have been the first that would have been running away. Now, in terms of the advance, what it meant was that there was a gap, a rather large gap in the line, ran about 4 miles in its length, between Pau Capelle and Steenstraat, and that defensive line was empty, and the Germans were pouring through it. What was going to happen next? A few months earlier in the First Battle of Ypres, the British just about stopped the Germans from getting to Ypres, but at this moment in time, it must have seemed to everybody that the city of Ypres was about to fall. Another Canadian, Major McNaughton, he was serving with the 7th Battery, Royal Field Artillery, and they were set up 1,000 yards south of St Julian, a British-held village that was at that time behind the lines. And he said suddenly a flood of Algerians came running back as if the devil was after them, their eyeballs showing white and coughing their lungs out. They literally were coughing their lungs out. Glue was coming out of their mouths. It was a very disturbing, very distressing sight. So what of young Henry Wenham, my great uncle? He was with A Company of the 2nd Battalion of the Buffs that I mentioned earlier. And when all this was going on, they were in reserve in the small hamlet of Saint-Jean, or what is now on the outskirts of Ypres. As the French troops were streaming down the road towards Ypres, the men of the Buffs, and no doubt my uncle, were standing in the streets of Saint-Jean, and the history of the Buffs says that they were standing nonchalantly, and the Canadians were calmly marching north and northeast in the direction where the Frenchmen were retreating. The Buffs took up a position covering Saint-Jean, facing north and northeast. And it was at this moment that the tide was turned to a certain extent, because the British and the Canadians decided it was time to make a stand. The Canadians would be supported by the commanding officer of the Buffs, a man called Geddes, and he was to form what was called a Geddes detachment. Now, this was really just a number of men that had been hastily cobbled together and put up under the command of Geddes. And it was their job to assist the Canadians, who were extremely hard-pressed at this stage. Now, it wasn't really much of a force, because it only consisted of a few half-strength battalions, some odd companies, and a few other battalions that had been drawn from the divisional reserve. And when you added up all the men, it only amounted to about 7 battalions that had been thinned and weakened by earlier casualties. But that's the best they could do. That's all they had. And every man was in the line defending the city of Ypres that stood before them, behind them. And if the Germans did manage to get behind them, there would be no reserves at all to stop them from taking Ypres and the canal bank and then reaching, of course, the Channel ports. There was 42 German battalions on the march and only 17 battalions of British and Canadians in their way. What would happen? Who would win the next battle? But before we tell that story, what's happened to those French colonial troops? Well, they've gone a long way back, as far, actually, of the canal that runs to the north of Ypres and to the village of Boesinghe. By the time the gas had reached there, it was travelling slowly. It was thinning out and spreading on the wind, but the fumes were still reaching the canal and even beyond it, spreading further alarm amongst the reserves of French who had not been close enough to fall victim to the gas in the early stages. But then even their eyes began to stream as the sickening fumes were sucked in with each gasping breath to burn their throats and affect their lungs. Then they saw the survivors of their frontline troops dragging their way towards them. Some were staggering and dropping to the ground, overcome with pain and exhaustion, and the retreat there became a rout. Men then tried to get across the narrow bridges that went across the Ypres Canal, but then some men collapsed and they were trampled underfoot in the panic. Some tried to swim across the canal, and some of them even drowned in that attempt. And many that made it to the other side of the canal couldn't go any further, and there they lay on the ground retching and gasping. They couldn't go any further. Those that remained on their feet carried on moving. They streamed across those fields and meadows towards Elverdingi and Valmatingi. Now, there was a man called de Melville, and he was living in a cottage just outside Bosingay, a civilian. But he was only a young boy. He was just 12 years old. But he says in his account he'll never forget that afternoon. It was shocking, he says. I was alone with my mother, and the little yard in front of our house was full of coloured soldiers lying on the ground or slumping against the wall. We could do nothing for them but give them water. We had two big metal jugs that held 2 or 3 litres apiece, and for hours I went back and forwards to the kitchen, filling them and filling them again, one after the other, or when my mother stayed outside, pouring it out for the soldiers to drink. More and more came along, wanting a drink as they passed. I poured water for hours and hours. After a while, I had to pump up more from the well at the back, because we soon used up what we had drawn that morning. They could not tell us what had happened, but we knew that it was something dreadful, and the Germans might come at any moment. We kept on pouring the water, even after it got dark. Much later in the night, some carts and ambulances came along to take those poor soldiers away. At least two of them were dead by then, and all the time, though, although no shells were falling near us, we could hear the guns. They never stopped. I could never forget it. So that was the situation on the first day of the battle. And it was in the early hours of the next morning at 2 a.m. that Colonel Geddes, the Geddes detachment, he received instructions that he was to act under orders of the Canadian division. And he had to cooperate with the Canadians that were on his left. An hour later, the Buffs marched in a northerly direction to get in touch with the 3rd Canadian Brigade. It took men some time to collect for the counterattack, and it wasn't until after 4 o'clock that the battalion moved off, but by this time, of course, it was broad daylight. About 800 yards they marched, and then they found some dugouts and trenches, which were occupied by the Canadians, and these trenches were screened by a hedge, and they used the hedge to close up. Beyond that was open country. So the battalion was at once deployed, and immediately it was subjected to furious machine gun and rifle fire from the enemy, who were entrenched in two parallel lines about 1,200 and 900 yards distant on the rising ground sloping to the north. So the problem they had there, that the Germans could see them moving up, and they opened fire on them. The Buffs then were moving at the double, platoon followed platoon in quick succession in the open, and many casualties occurred. Two companies soon reached a farm 400 yards on, while the remaining company took advantage of the frail cover afforded by a fence 150 yards behind the farm. The Buffs then advanced in rushes across the open and lost heavily. Captain Ronald being killed, Lieutenant Wilkins severely wounded, and some 80 casualties of other ranks occurring. Two companies occupied the front line, while the third was in a trench facing east along the GHQ wire, which is the last fortified line back from the enemy. And the fact that our troops were now practically defending that meant, of course, that the enemy had penetrated all defences but one on this northern flank of the Ypres salient. In the rest of the day, the battalion was subjected to heavy shelling and rifle fire. The Buffs then completely occupied the gap between them and Canadian countries. I'm reading this, of course, from the book by R.S. Moody, Colonel R.S.H. Moody, The Historical Records of the Buffs in the First World War. And it seems that Geddes and his small task of men, including my great uncle Henry, had saved the day to a certain extent. They teamed up with the Canadians, and by counter-attacking, they stopped the Germans from breaking through. But then disaster struck on the 28th. Geddes was obviously a brilliant leader, and they said he had a fine future in front of him. He handled this critical situation and without doubt prevented the Germans from pressing home the attack that had begun on the 22nd. But then he was killed by a shell, and he's now one of those soldiers that's buried in the Ypres Reservoir Cemetery that we talked about last week. So who was that brave and talented man, Lieutenant Colonel Augustus David Geddes? He went to Sandhurst in 1885 and 2 years later joined the Buffs, and he reached his present rank, Lieutenant Colonel, 4 years before he died in 1911. He'd been a captain and an adjutant during the Boer War, and had been severely wounded. When he recovered, he became a staff officer, and for his services, he received the Queen's Medal with 5 clasps. He got 2 brothers, Brigadier John Gordon Geddes and Lieutenant George Geddes, and they were serving at that stage with the Royal Artillery. One of the other officers that it mentioned being killed there was Captain James McBain Ronald. He was the son of Mr. Robert Ronald of Tunbridge Wells, and they lived near Canterbury. He was 39 years old, educated at Harrow and Sandhurst. He received his commission in 1896. He'd served with the 2nd Buffs in the South African, the Boer War, was mentioned in dispatches, and he also received the Queen's Medal, but with 4 clasps, and the King's Medal with 2 clasps. He'd retired in 1912, but resumed service as a railway transport officer in August 1914, and he'd rejoined the Buffs just a few weeks before he was killed, and he left a widow and a daughter. Now, sometimes these official accounts of what happened can be quite dry. They give us the facts, but we still don't know what it was like to be there. But we do in this case, because in the Kent Messenger newspaper a few weeks later, an anonymous soldier wrote a letter to his friends, which ended up in the newspaper. And he says, "I must say I'm very lucky, for we have had it about as hot as one could wish for. We were just on 1,000 strong when I wrote you last, and now we cannot muster 300, so you would guess what it's been like. We've had just 23 days of it, and now we're back for a rest to make up our strength." On that day, the 23rd, he said, "We'd been out all the night before, and were returning, almost walking in our sleep, when we had orders to reinforce the Canadians. It was by then daylight, but we had to go. We had not marched far before we came under heavy rifle fire, just enough to wake us up. That was in the road, and my brother was the first to go down. He shouted, 'Oh, oh,' and fell. It seemed hard not to be able to attend to him, but of course, when advancing, no one except stretcher bearers must stop. However, I fancy he was soon picked up, got away. After that, our men began to drop all around, so we extended and took cover behind a hedge. But we were no good there. It was a case of getting right on. We'd had almost 1,000 yards to go over flat ground, and we did it in short rushes. Oh, what a hailstone we had when we started to advance. I can tell you it's a sensation that you don't want every day. I managed to reach the trench safely, and I shall never forget the sight when I look back over the ground we had covered." He goes on to say, for 4 days the battalion remained in the trench that they'd been sent to occupy. He says, "No doubt you will guess where we were by reading the papers. You can take it from me that the Canadians are all that the papers say of them. But they might just mention the regiments that helped save the Germans breaking through. It was a near thing. You should have seen the poor Frenchmen that retired when the Germans used poisonous gases. It played our eyes up where we were. What were left of us came away pretty nearly done up, but with very little to eat and not much sleep. I can tell you, it is very trying to the nerves and system. My opinion is it will be a very long job yet. We've got a hard nut to crack, but we must keep at it until we've got the job done properly. I've seen some terrible artillery duels and shelling, but the things I dislike most are those awful trench mortars used by the Germans. It's all up with the men and trench if they get the proper range. If you keep a careful watch, you can see them coming both day and night, and when they explode, the report is deafening." Now, somewhere along the way over those few days, Henry Wenham was wounded by a machine gun bullet in both feet, and it makes sense that that occurred whilst they were moving across that large expanse of field round what is now known as Mousetrap Farm. Another graphic account also comes from a soldier from Kent, but he was a Private G. Knott, and he was serving with the 1st Gloucesters. And he'd been wounded for the third time when he wrote back to his mum. He said, "I should have written before, only I did not know how long I should be in hospital in France, so I suppose you think me dead by this time, but I'm very much alive and kicking. I think my fighting days are over after this lot, for I shall never be any good for marching after this. Well, if they are, I've done my part. Now let someone else have a go." He went on to say, "I've got a compound fracture, and it is just above the ankle. I thought my foot was gone when it was done. It was caused by a bullet, and I shall be here a long time. It is very tiring laying on my back all the time, for I cannot shift my leg, even a little bit, because it's in splints. I got this lot last Sunday week, and it was just like hell itself. I thought I was never going to get through it alive, but here I am, thank God. I never want to see the sights I saw there any more. The poor chaps there were gassed. It is a pity to see them gasping for breath, but we now may be using the same on the Germans, to see how they like it. They are nothing but a lot of savages. They have no pity for anyone, not even their own wounded. After we captured a line of their trenches, we who found two or three wounded men chained to their machine guns because their spirit was broken and they used to run away. That will tell you what they are. And if any of them are seen giving themselves up to us, they are cut down by their own artillery. Just reading that, it sends a shiver down my spine, knowing that a relative of mine experienced that. He was wounded in that. And just seeing the pure hatred that this particular man had for the enemy. Now, I mentioned earlier that the civilians were still living in Ypres at this stage and also in the surrounding villages. And so the attack must have come as a great shock to them. And we've got some evidence of that. First of all, from the Kent Messenger. And this account was written by Colonel F.B. Mildmay, who was actually a Member of Parliament whilst he was serving at the front. He talked about things being very black overnight because the Germans had broken through the French line. He then goes on to tell us about the civilians. He says that farms and buildings burning all around the horizon, denser smoke, the wretched population hurrying down the road in family groups, the father with probably all the world's belongings left to the family in a bundle so pathetically small, the mother with a set face of mute agony, with one child perhaps in her arm, the other hand helping along a second mite at a pace just too fast for it to keep up, a third child just lagging a little behind, clasping some cherished childhood possession. No tears, things had gone too far for that. They didn't know where they were going, what was their future. Is there a future at all for them? It doesn't look like it. Their every step down the road is being plastered with shrapnel. I pictured to myself you and the two children stumbling along under such circumstances. What an awful sin lies at the door of German militarism in having callously and light-heartedly spread this appalling misery in the homes of unoffending people. There was a Private W. Hay, and he was with the 9th Battalion of the Royal Scots, and they were part of the Geddes Detachment. And he describes again what it must have been like, or what it was like actually. And he says, he starts off by saying, we knew there was something wrong. We started to march towards Ypres, but we couldn't get past on the road because it was absolutely solid with troops marching up and with refugees coming down the road. We couldn't pass them, so we had to go up the railway line halfway to Ypres, and there were people, civilians and soldiers lying along the roadside in a terrible state. The position that he's talking about there is the straight road that goes between Ypres and Poperinghe. It's where most people make their approach to Ypres when they come to visit the battlefields. When you turn right, coming out of Poperinghe, you go down that road and the railway line is still there on your left. You'll then see the village of Valamatingi. And it was along that road that this Private Hayes talking about, where the civilians and soldiers were lying along the roadside. He goes on, he said, we heard them say it was gas. We didn't know what the hell gas was. We knew the people must be trying to get away from Ypres, and we could see Ypres up ahead of us, all on fire, blazing. Eventually, we got the word to move on, and we had pretty mixed feelings when we got to the outskirts, and we knew we were going to have to run the gauntlet through the fire, with shells falling all the time. The whole town seemed to be on fire. It was a terrible sight, appalling. He said, we got to the big square opposite the town hall. There was blazing and smoking and shells everywhere. We could feel the flames of the fire hot in our faces. Ypres was being demolished, literally razed to the ground, with bricks and mortar flying everywhere. It was miraculous how we all got through. But eventually we got out onto the Menin Road and there wasn't a single casualty in the whole battalion. I've always thought that was a miracle. That night we didn't have time to think of anything but getting away from Ypres and getting up the line. We were up in the line by dawn and we waited there in bitter cold until the early morning. And of course we didn't know really what was happening. There was a lot of Canadians lying there dead from the gas on the day before, poor devils. And it was quite a horrible sight for us young men. I was only 20. It was quite traumatic and I've never forgotten that. Nor will I ever forget it. We were in a ditch in a sunken road, and lying there, rifle loaded and all ready, we were told to fix bayonets, and I was really apprehensive. We were all definitely scared, thinking that we were going to have hand-to-hand fighting, which wasn't what I thought I'd have to do. I thought we'd be firing rifles. I didn't expect to be going bayonet fighting with the Germans. No, I didn't expect that. We got the order to advance, just to go forward a bit, because there was no barbed wire there and it was open country. But we went no further because it was getting late in the evening, so we were told to start digging rifle pits, one to each man, so they could be joined up to make the forerunner of a trench. I was digging with David Newbury. We were both young men and we didn't know the name of psychology, but we'd both been brought up reading the old school magazines and we heard all the tales about Germans being frightened of the Highlanders. We came to the conclusion together that if both of us made for one German, it would frighten the wits out of him if he saw two Highlanders come at him with their bayonets. We thought that if we looked ferocious enough as we ran at the German, he'd just pack it in and run away, and maybe that would influence the others to do the same. That was our idea, but we never got a chance to put it into practice. When we began to advance, the machine guns opened on us and David got a bullet across his forehead and his blood was running all down my face. I thought he was killed, but even though he was my best pal, I wasn't allowed to stop and tie him up. We had to go on, so we went further and further to a little hollow in the ground and got into it. We couldn't see any Germans there because we were really undercover in that slight hollow and the Germans were machine gunning over our heads. Then the captain got a bullet in his thigh, Captain Taylor. Of course, we were stopped then, so I managed to tie it up roughly for him and the stretcher bearers took him as he went away. He told us to get on and dig those rifle pits. We had to get over this stream where all the trees had been knocked down by shellfire, so we clambered over them, hanging onto the branches to get the other side and start digging this line, such as it was. For some reasons, the Germans didn't come on. If they had, we'd all been massacred. A few hours later, we were pulled out and rushed back to Sanctuary Wood. And that went on for 4 days, backwards and forwards, out and in, here and there. We never knew where we were or what we were supposed to be doing. As I'm reading that, I'm thinking two other things. They're talking about digging rifle pits. There's no real trenches at this stage. There are trenches from their original positions, but once they get out of those, there's no real other positions to give them any kind of cover. And whilst they're doing this, they're not wearing the steel helmets that we see in the images soldiers wearing in the latter stages of the war from the Battle of the Somme onwards. No, these guys are still wearing those peaked caps, which gave them absolutely no protection against rifle fire or shell fire or anything for that matter. So a blow to the head would normally result in a serious wound and probably death. The absolute horror of battle is recorded by a Major McDonnell, who was serving with the 9th Battery of the Canadian Field Artillery. He says, "There was one of our fellows who got shot in the stomach. He was bleeding pretty good from the wound, so I got a twig off the shrub, wrapped a bandage around it and shoved it in the hole. I took him down to a house they were using for casualties and laid him down beside some steps in one of the rooms. I left and went back to the guns. Years later, he told me when the Germans took the house, they started bayoneting the wounded. He pulled a man that had died earlier on top of him and the Germans passed him by." And it's incredible to think how horrific must that have been. Pull a corpse on top of you, probably a man that's still warm, maybe blood dripping from his wounds. And that's actually saved that man's life. What a horrible thing war is and the things that people do. That survivor's instinct that nature has given human beings. And basically we know that instinct of survival, you'll do anything to keep yourself a few more moments on planet Earth. So we're still on that one day, the 22nd of April 1915. I was going to talk about what happened on the following day, the 23rd, in more detail, but we're running out of time here. So let's just look at what was happening to those refugees that we talked about. They're continuing to struggle westward out of those villages on the salient that had now been caught up in the battle. There were sounds of continual wailing and crying, crashing buildings in the city of Ypres, and the screaming roar of heavy shells mingled with the steady crackling of the flames. These buildings, of course, were on fire. And through this, the inhabitants of those villages east of Ypres jostled along the road and the railway tracks towards the village of Valamatingi. They were trying to get to the railway station that was there at that time, and they were hoping to board one of the crowded trains. You can imagine the scene, can't you? It must have been absolutely chaotic. These people carrying their belongings, dragging along their kids with them, crying, upset. A frantic crowd of refugees. One witness said there was women, children and badly wounded and gassed soldiers were placed on board the waiting train. The brute rush of the frenzied townsmen beaten back, discipline and some semblance of order preserved. This was a man called Hugh Pollard who's written this. He says, at midnight the last train left the shattered ruins of Valamatingi, crowded with women and wounded. Shells wailed and wept over the village and the permanent way behind the train was hit again and again by a dozen long-range shells. So our final story, it will take us to where the Menin Gate stands to this day. And as you approach the Menin Gate from the city of Ypres down the Meninstraat, imagine in your mind's eye that the gate is not there. The Menin Gate isn't there. It's the 22nd of April 1915. Instead, there's a pub on the corner. And it's about 6 o'clock in the evening an hour after the Germans have launched their massive gas attack. And of course, their artillery is firing into the town, as we know. And in that pub is a lady called Eugenie Devries. And that's where she lived. But some of those shells hit the pub, hit that inn where the family lived. And in total, in the pub and the houses nearby, 28 people were killed and buried beneath the rubble. Eugenie died, so did her husband. Her children died with her, and also her parents, two sisters, two nephews, and two brother-in-laws. An entire family of civilians of the city of Ypres that no doubt had lived there a long time had been killed on the day that the gas was released. But of course, they stayed buried under that rubble until the end of the war, and it was only when the rubble was cleared away that their bodies were found, and they were buried in the Ypres town cemetery nearby. So what were the casualties in this second Battle of Ypres? Don't forget, the battle lasted for several weeks, not just the 22nd of April 1915. And John Dixon, in his book Magnificent But Not War, he's got a table in there which lists the casualties of the British and the Canadian divisions, but not the French. Of course, the French colonial troops suffered dreadfully. These figures are not here. But he lists officers killed 501, wounded 1,412, and missing 237. Of the other ranks that we know, 10,018 were killed, 30,922 were wounded, including my great uncle Henry, and missing an enormous 16,185. And that makes a grand total, the British and Canadian ranks, of 59,275, roughly the amount of casualties on the first day of the Somme. And each one of those casualties is, of course, a human life. It always amazes me how they managed to discover the amount of casualties in a war to be so accurate. It can't be accurate, can it? It must be a best guess. And of course, in the passage of time, people are always coming up with more information, which will give a more accurate figure than the figures that John used when he wrote his book. And his book was published in 2003, so that's 20 years ago now. So after a month of terrible fighting, backwards and forwards, more gas attacks, the Second Battle of Ypres grinds to a halt on the 25th of May 1915. And the man that we turn to at the beginning of the podcast, Sir John French, the Commander-in-Chief of the BEF at the time, he made the following address. I came over to say a few words to you and to tell you how much I, as Commander-in-Chief of the Army, appreciate the splendid work that you've all done during the recent fighting. You fought the Second Battle of Ypres, which will rank amongst the most desperate and hardest fights of the war. You may have thought, because you were not attacking the enemy, that you were not helping to shorten the war. On the contrary, by your splendid endurance and bravery, you've done a great job to shorten it. By your steadiness and devotion, both the German plans were frustrated. The enemy was unable to get possession of Ypres. If it had done this, he would probably have succeeded in preventing neutral powers from intervening. Had you failed to repulse his attacks and made it necessary for more troops to be sent to your assistance, our operations in the south might not have been able to take place, and they would certainly not have been as successful as they have been. So he was talking about a joint offensive with the French further south. I want you all to understand how thoroughly I realise and appreciate what you have done. I wish to thank you, each officer, non-commissioned officer and man, for the services you rendered by doing your duty so magnificently, and I'm sure your country will thank you too. But of course, those men who were dead or whose lives had been shattered probably didn't appreciate his words. That's if they could hear them, of course. One day, I hope you'll visit the scene of this awful battle in the spring of 1915. And if you do, the best place to go and think about it is Vancouver Corner. And this was the position where the Canadians held their ground after the Germans had broken through the French defences. And when you park your vehicle up at Vancouver Corner, you'll walk through the hedges into a beautiful garden. And there you'll look up at the brooding soldier, as it's become known. It was designed by an architect called Frederick Clemescher. His design comprised a single tower of stone that you'll see now, And sitting on top of it are the heads and shoulders of a soldier. And this soldier has got his head bowed and is leaning on his rifle, reversed arms they call it, with the rifle butt at the top and the rifle with its barrel pointing to the ground. This memorial towers above you. It's 11 metres high. And on the base of this beautiful memorial is inscribed these words. It says, "This column marks the battlefield where 18,000 Canadians on the British left withstood the first German gas attacks on the 22nd to the 24th of April, 1915. 2,000 fell and here lied buried." The memorial here, which is close to the village of St Julian, was unveiled by His Royal Highness the Duke of Connaught on the 8th of July 1923. The Commander-in-Chief of all of the Allied armies, Marshal Ferdinand Foch, he was present and paid tribute to the Canadian forces. He thanked them for their sacrifice and he extended the gratitude of the entire French nation for the Canadians' part in the First World War. Many of those Canadians who died were never recovered and they're still in those fields around St Julian. Their names are recorded on the Meningate Memorial and those that made it back to the casualty clearing stations or the advanced dressing stations, they're buried in cemeteries close to where they treated whilst they were being evacuated from the battlefields. It's a very emotive place to stand. Many people regard this memorial as their favourite, if that's the right word. And as you do stand there, look around and just try to imagine what the scene must have been like on that spring, beautiful spring day 108 years ago. It's impossible to think about, it's impossible to imagine. But as we do, we thank those soldiers for their efforts, their sacrifice that mean that we can live the life that we do today. And we remember, as usual, the fallen of that battle on all sides, including the Germans, by playing The Last Post.